Hello, Kieran. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, I'm present on this mortal coil, marching ever closer to my impending fate. But, you know, apart from that, pretty good.
Aren't we all? Well, yeah. We're back in lockdown, so I feel like this is going to be our inevitable fate for the rest of our lives. Just cycles of going back to work a little bit and going to the shops a bit more. And then just coming back and living in your house 24/7.
I think we'll probably get to watch like the Slipknot hologram show in 2053. But the day before, one of us will pop our clogs, so we'll never actually see each other face to face again.
Yeah, that's probably going to be the way forward, isn't it? Hologram gigs. Yeah, it's crazy all this lockdown nonsense. But I mean, it's lockdown, but it's also, what is it today? Is it the 6th of November today?
Yes,
it's the 7th of November today, which means it's that time of year where all the crazy people put their Christmas decorations up.
Yeah, we got a bit of some strange looks because we actually put Halloween decorations up like 2 or 3 weeks before Halloween because
in March.
Kristen's American, and apparently you put them up earlier in America. But then the joke was on everyone else because they all bricked it and then they put all theirs up shortly after hours. Wow. So I think it's just whoever does it first that then gives the green light to everyone else that it's socially and culturally acceptable. So
that's like when you go around to like someone's house and they bring like a bowl of crisps out or something for you to eat, and then everyone's like, I don't want to be the first one to eat the crisps, but then someone eats it, and then once that happens they just go.
It's like, I thought you were gonna say, it's like when you go to someone's house and they bring out a bowl of keys and you're like, oh, thank God, I thought there was a bit of tension.
Oh no, I do not hesitate when that happens. I dive right in. It makes family events much more awkward, but, you know, confidence is key.
Dear me.
Yeah. Let's change the subject.
Did you see the story? Sorry, go on.
No. Sorry, I'm too excited. I've got too many words to get out. What were you saying?
I was just going to say, did you see the story that I just put on Instagram?
Yeah. Of you and your amazing little, like, blonde highlight in your hair.
Yeah, I had I found a photo today on that was on Memories or whatever that was 15 years old, and it's me and Kristen stood outside the Tower of London, and I've got like ripped jeans, some shoes I think I bought from the Officers Club because they were 70% off and always were 70% off, and I've also got like a blonde mohawk, but instead of it being down the middle, I'm like cool AF and it's kind of on the side. It looks terrible.
It does not look terrible. It looks great, and I would like you to bring it back.
I don't think anyone wants me to bring it back.
Someone, Mosher Mags. I made good friends with Mosher Mags. You should check out the Mosher Mags Instagram account because its quality. It's just like old issues of crying and stuff from like back in the day. It's really, really cool. Check it out. But we got a message from Mosher Mags, and I just said, "Oh yeah, that." My first reaction was that guy looks like he listens to Creed.
Oh God, that's really upsetting.
Yeah, I actually once I typed it, I was a bit like, that was maybe a little bit mean. Maybe not Creed, maybe Alter Bridge. Maybe that's a bit more acceptable.
I think just like butt rock in general, which we only kind of, I only learned recently, butt rock is the genre where it's kind of based on the whole like nothing but rock that was on like classic 90s radio stations, not to do with like bums and arses and asses.
But I kind of feel like, I don't know how, but butt rock as in your butt kind of fits the genre somehow. I don't know why. Like, it kind of feels like that's the right term for it, as in ass rock. Or in America, fanny rock.
What, because it's rubbish?
No, not because it's rubbish. I don't know. I just feel like, I don't know, like if you turn up to, you know, I think we discussed it in this week's episode, didn't we? But I think if you turn up to like a five-finger death punch rehearsal, I feel like everyone there would be like, yeah, butt rock.
Why?
Oh, I don't know. I'm obviously like far superior to you in my musical knowledge. I don't know. Just sounds right, doesn't it? Butt rock. Like, this song is, you know, melodic. It's nice, but it needs to be a bit more butt rock. Like, my butt rocks.
What?
I don't know. Just butt rock.
Okay. There we go. Butt rock. It's about... It's a genre about... Oh dear. I tell you what probably isn't like fits in with the nothing but rock or butt rock attitude. It's my current fascination with a new reality show on Hey You about gardening called Backyard Envy. Actually, do you know what? It's called Backyard Envy. It totally fits in. It's just this episode is just about asses and butts, nothing else. Backyard Envy, yeah. It's not about people looking at each other's bums and being like, damn, that's a great butt. It's about flowers and gardens. And these guys who help other people transform their outdoor spaces. And I tell you what, there are some beautiful perennials, some amazing trees, and just all kinds of lovely flowers. And I think it's really heightened my appreciation of gardening, which is something I don't do enough of, if you ask my wife.
Yeah, to be honest, I do feel that your knowledge of gardening is quite a subpar. So I'm pleased that you've, you know, decided to grow up a little bit and you know, be mature and learn about the, you know, the joys of what just the posh word for gardening. What's horticulture? Is that gardening?
I think so. I the other day I got confused between perennials and millennials, so I'm probably not the person to ask. I'm a perennial.
I'm Googling horticulture now. Oh, the agriculture of plants, yeah. Mainly of food materials, comfort and beauty for decoration. Budrock.
If people who played buttrock grew flowers, what flowers would they be?
They would be...
He's Googling.
A chrysanthemum.
Five-finger daffodil. Oh, in this episode as well, we joke with Serena about how I've never listened to Five Finger Death Punch and how, like, it's my goal in life to never hear a Five Finger Death Punch song. And then I swear, like, a few hours after we finished our chat with her, because I'm sure my phone listens to everything I do and say and then turns it into an advert, there was, like, some sponsored Facebook thing and it was a new Five Finger Death Punch song. Oh, man, I heard, like, 6 seconds of it. So I'm done now. I've heard it. And yeah, it was, yeah.
So you've already gone back on your word already. Literally 20 minutes after you spoke to her, you decided that you'll go back on your word and you check out Five Finger Death Punch.
Yeah, it's not for me. I see why some people like it. It's very accessible and it's very kind of, I don't know, like cartoonish, like kind of like larger than life and like really, I don't know, really cringeworthy like lyrics. But yeah, not for me. And I'm disappointed that I've let myself down by hearing it now.
Well, there goes any chance of us getting Five Finger Death Punch on the podcast.
I don't think I'd ask based on what I'd heard. I mean, you know, we get people on who we like. I just couldn't. There's certain people I just couldn't talk to.
Budrock.
You're one of them.
Yeah, I think it's going that way quite quickly.
This is what I've been leading up to. We need to have a chat about the future of this podcast.
We've had a really exciting week in our household this week.
Why is that?
We finally got some new carpet.
Yes.
This, honestly, I can't believe how excited we have got over getting carpet. This house, we've been in the house 10 months now and like lockdown happened and everything shut down. So we've been waiting to recarpet the stairs for ages because the people that lived it was like this, I don't know, it was like something from the 70s or something. It was like this horrible brown, like just horrible carpet. And I'm pretty sure they fitted it themselves. It didn't like line up with the doors properly. And I'm sure if I'd have given it a tug, it would have just come straight up. So you can imagine how excited we were to finally get some new carpet. And it's at the point where I think every time one of us goes up or downstairs, we're like, oh yeah, yeah, new carpet. It's quite sad, really.
Is it just on the stairs?
On the stairs and on the landing, yeah, which you've seen my house, you know, right. That, you know, there's, you know, a long, long flight of stairs, about 150 stairs. And then the landing is, you know, size of a tennis court-ish. So it's quite a big job.
I have been around Kieran's house and I think he might be bending the truth a little bit. There's 99 steps up to Whitby Abbey. So I'm pretty sure yours isn't 150.
I mean, give or take, like it's probably roughly about those sizes. But then the downside is little Dwight, our dog, has decided to completely untrain himself and now partakes in urinating on the floor wherever he wants. So we're literally like terrified that he's going to pee on the carpet at some point. So we've got to keep an eye on him. I don't know what's wrong with him. I think it's because the weather's got cold. Like, it was raining a lot last week. Yeah. So he wouldn't go outside to go to the toilet because it was raining. So he had to force him to go outside. Then the weather got better. And then now he always wants to go outside, but he doesn't want to go to the toilet. So now it's not raining as much. He sits yelping by the back door. So you let him out, then he walks out and just stands there and looks at you. So it's this kind of like delicate balance between, do I force him to go outside? Do I leave him in? Do I let him out? Do I risk him, you know, peeing on the carpet? I have to say it's been, you know, it's been great to have carpet, but oh my, the dog urination timetable is very difficult.
Oh, hang on a minute. Come here, Logan. What are you saying?
I pee, Daddy.
What are you saying?
I pee.
There we go.
Better not be on my new carpet.
That was my 3-year-old telling us he needs a poo. Thanks for coming, Logan.
I thought he said he'd done a poo.
I hope not, because I haven't heard him on the toilet. Do you know what you should do, though, to make it more fun with Dwight? I mean, not make it more fun. It can't really get more fun than what it is. Why don't you, like, draw... Have you seen, I think, is it Spain? I can't remember where they do this. Where they do, like, the cow lottery thing, where they draw a grid on the grass, and wherever the cow does a crap, that person wins money. Everyone bets on a square. You should do that. Just put on, like, a massive grid in your living room. You and Claire put bets on each number. At least, I mean, to be fair, actually, if you're a couple... You're only taking it off yourself, aren't you? So yeah. Scrap that.
Well, it's one way to spice up a marriage.
It's a couples counselling. They're like, have you ever thought about drawing a grid on your living room floor and seeing which one the dog shits in? That'll bring you closer together.
Have you ever done dog bowel movement bingo? Everyone's doing it these days.
Do you know, though, with the weather getting cold, I've done something... That
what have you done? I don't know. What's this leading on to?
No, it's not that bad. So I've got a greyhound, Luna, and greyhounds have like 0.8% body fat. They're just like muscle and very little fur. And she gets really cold, and I've been noticing that even with the heating on, she's kind of curled up into a little ball in the corner of her bed. So we bought her some pajamas the other day. And they're like, they're amazing. They're like, I'm jealous of them. They look really good. They got like a little like Steve Jobs turtleneck. And then they've got like, they go down to almost the bottom of her legs.
Is it like a onesie?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But like there's a cut out around her tail. So she still wants to go to the loo, she can. So it's like ultimate convenience and comfort.
That's amazing. Yeah. Cause I was walking Dwight the other day and then this dog ran past that had, it looked like a onesie, but I just thought it looked really strange. It looked like some sort of kind of Victorian era person walking around in their pajamas, but
got like ruffles around their neck.
Yeah, and like, you know, like a little hat with like a little thing on the end.
A powdered face with two big red dots on the cheek. And they were playing an accordion. I don't even know if accordions are accordions aren't a Victorian instrument, are they?
Playing an accordion and shitting into a grid.
Oh,
we come in here to talk about music.
Yeah, maybe if I tell you what, if we want to monetize the podcast, forget about sponsors, forget about collaborations, we'll just live stream our dogs in the garden and drew a little, you can get spray paint that fades away, that's temporary. We'll just do that in the garden and make people put money on each square, basically run a gambling operation. I think that's fine. I don't think you have to tell anyone about that. It's okay.
How many people can you have in your garden at the minute legally? I'm just trying to work out the kind of profit we could make.
Well, you don't need it because you just live stream it and then you get people to bet on each square.
Yeah. Improvise, adapt, overcome.
Yeah.
Budrock.
Poor Serena, our lovely guest Serena this week. She must be listening to this thinking, they didn't tell me about what kind of content goes into the intro before they speak to a guest.
this well thought out, extremely meticulously planned intro conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, much like the roller coasters that she is passionate about, that's very much like our intros, you know, like a dark ride where you don't know where the track's going. It's like, where will it go next? Will it be dog poo? Will it be, you know, new carpet? Will it be Marmite?
I thought you were going to make a Ronan and Keating analogy.
I'm sure we did. We've done that already, haven't we?
We probably have. I feel like we have already, but we did talk about roller coasters quite a bit with Serena. Do you know what? I really enjoyed this. I enjoy all of them, but I really, really enjoyed this chat because as we, I think when we came off afterwards, we were talking about, oh, just, it was nice. It felt like we were talking to someone we'd known a long time, and we ended up going on quite a few rambling tangents about things that weren't necessarily how good Serena is as a guitarist and a vocalist in Svalbard, and how great their music is, which it is. Mm. We kind of went off and talked about other things too, didn't we?
Yeah, well, it's cool when you get someone like that who's obviously really passionate about other things, because obviously we interview them to speak to the person, and, you know, the first thing is the music. You know, we've got to like the band and enjoy the band, and it's cool to always talk about the music. But yeah, I like it when you go off on a bit of a tangent and you know, there's something else to say, because sometimes it, you know, you can get a bit dry, being like, oh, tell us about your band, what are the influences for the album, who did this, who did that, let's talk about roller coasters and Halloween.
Yeah, man. Maybe we should get, when we get Five Finger Death Punch on, maybe we could talk about their favorite condiments or something.
Yeah, maybe they're into gardening. Maybe they're into dog bowel movement bingo. Who knows?
Nobody knows. But yeah, this was a really good chat. We, as I said, we covered quite a lot of different stuff. Serena was a great guest, and I think we just had a good time recording this.
Yeah, yeah. And definitely, if you haven't already, check out their new album, because yeah, it'll melt your face off a bit. I think we talked as well in the episode about, you know, cooking dinner and listen to this album, and it's wicked. Like, honestly, if you look at your cooking instructions and it says it'll take 20 minutes, put this album on, it'll take 5 max. It's that good, it gets you pumped.
But only 6% of what you're cooking will actually end up on the plate, because the rest will be stained across your kitchen walls as you vigorously stir or throw whatever you were going to eat at anything around you in a fit of pure anger and celebration.
Yeah,
maybe that's what they should put on the front of this album. That's a bit of a long quote, though.
Who knows? Not endorsed by Ainsley Harriet in any way.
Yeah. Anyway,
well, yeah, we should introduce today's episode, shouldn't we, really?
Yeah, we probably should,
unless you've got any more bowel movements to talk about.
I really don't, mate. I think we've covered both human and animal. So this is episode 12 of Two Off This Pit with Serena Cherry from Svalbard.
Butt rock.
Welcome to Too Old for This Pit, episode 12. Today we have a guest for a band who've really proven themselves to be a force to be reckoned with in the UK scene, and we're really hyped about the new album, When I Die, Will I Get Better?
Yep, and fresh off their third release, which has already been described as the closest they have come to pure perfection, we're really excited to welcome Serena Cherry, who is the self-proclaimed guitars and growls for Bristol-based Svalbard. So, good evening, Serena, how are you?
Hello, lovely to be here. Thanks for having me. First, I'd like to congratulate you on getting the album title right.
Oh, yeah.
Have people got it wrong?
Oh, everyone. Yeah, yeah. It's been a bit embarrassing. There was one the other day, like, on the radio live, and they said the album title wrong. I didn't.
Luckily, when you confirmed to come on, we had about 5 days of just rehearsing the album title. So what have people got it confused with? What have they called it?
The main one is When I Die, Will It Get Better? Or, yeah, like, just sort of strange rearranging of the phrases and stuff. Will I get better when I die? That, you know, that kind of thing.
When I die, will there be a funeral due to current COVID Tier 3 regulations?
That sounds like a daytime TV ad where you get a free pen when you subscribe.
When I eat pie, will I get fatter?
That could be the final 100%. Part.
I had pie for dinner and I feel terrible now, so
you're about to die. Yeah, well, to be fair, the band name as well, we said before, we're like, it is Svalbard, isn't it? Because the place name, I don't know if that's pronounced differently or whether it's the same thing.
It is Svalbard. I think the people from Svalbard pronounce it Svalbard because the W's and the V's are different the other way around in Scandinavia. But yeah, it's Svalbard. But we took our name from Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy of books, not from the place necessarily.
Good job we didn't call it Svalbard then.
Have you played gigs in Svalbard? You must have played.
No, yeah, I feel like, no. Yeah, one day we will. We'll go and play to an audience purely of polar bears. It's hard to get there, though. It's one of those places where you need to take about 5 planes and a bus and a canoe and,
Well, to be fair, I think Metallica did that, didn't they? Didn't they play in the Arctic or something a few years back?
Yeah, they did. Oh, they've beaten us to it again.
I know. Sick of Metallica stealing all your ideas.
Yeah. That album we would release for Lou Reed.
Where Kieran lives anyway, you need to get like 2 trains, and you have to get a Sherpa at the other end to get up the hill in Ramsbottom.
Yeah, there's like a really weird, there's like this guy you have to cross his palm with silver and then he takes you across the river and then you get to my house.
I put your postcode in and it was just the middle of a field.
That's pretty much where I live. It's just I'm in a house in the middle of a field. Yeah.
Father Ted.
Anyway, on to Svalbard. Let's start with the album. So you've had, you've had some really good reviews on the album already. You must be pretty buzzing to have such a good response to it.
Yeah, it's been really strange. It's been really strange because obviously of the sort of COVID times. Normally when you release an album, all your feedback comes from playing those album release shows and seeing people react in person to the new songs. Yeah. And not having that element of things has felt really strange, because for a while it was sort of like, oh, it's released, but it doesn't feel like it's released. But the response it's had online and in the press has been amazing. Like, I sort of can't believe it. There's people saying stuff like album of the year, and I'm like, well, they clearly haven't heard the new Nightwish album for a start. that's a huge overestimation of us. But like, I'm really, really happy that it's definitely, personally, it's my favourite album that we've ever done. So it's nice to see everyone receive it so well as well.
It builds on the previous couple of albums, doesn't it? But it feels quite different at the same time. There's a more of the clean singing and these kind of huge dramatic melodies.
Yeah, exactly. We basically listened to a lot more Alcest.
Oh, cool.
Toured with bands like Envy, and I think that really influenced how this album came out, really influenced the songwriting. And in terms of things like the clean singing, it was a confidence thing. So for the first 2 albums, there's little bits of it, quiet sections here and there, but not a lot really. And then it was sort of building my confidence to be able to really sort of, you know, maybe try the clean singing over heavier guitars and stuff like that. We're yet to see how it's going to work live, because my scream is a lot louder than my singing voice. So it might be a 2 microphone job scenario there. But yeah, definitely, like, I feel like we've taken the elements of us from the previous 2 records, but then expanded a lot further from that into new territories.
Were you expecting such a good response to it when you'd written it, and, you know, when you first heard the final mixes or anything? Did you expect it to be so well received? Or
whenever we write music, we're incredibly critical. Like, it took us 2.5 years to write this album because so much ends up on the cutting room floor. So I think we're not the best people to ask, like, oh, do you think people are going to like it? Because we're always like, oh God, what if everything we do is shit? I think we go into it with our usual kind of attitude of like, oh no, it's not going to be good enough. But then I do remember sitting in the ranch and hearing Lewis play back first mixes and thinking, oh wow, like this sounds amazing. Like, I am really pleased. Like, I don't normally listen to like my own music, but this is the album, like, you know, I like putting it on and riffing along and go, yeah, I like this. It's good.
It's really interesting how much artists and musicians spend on tons of songs that never actually make it through to the final album. We had, that's just some money coming out of my account. £8.05 at the Modern Milkman. There we go.
By the way, we are rock and roll through and through.
Yeah, got to get my oat milk. What was I even saying? There's a lot of bands, obviously, that spend tons of time kind of writing songs, playing songs that just don't make it on the final album. Was that the case with this, or was it more just taking what you had and constantly reiterating and kind of perfecting it?
there's a lot that didn't make it on the album, and it's been the same with every album we've done. There's songs that we've written and we've gotten sort of 90% of the way through and everything, and then gone, oof, it's just not quite gelling, it's not quite working together. And I think we're one of those bands, we'd always rather have a shorter album, 8 songs that we're like, think that we're the best we can do, rather than 12 songs and 4 of them are the ones that you skip, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like quite a lot of songs and ideas and all sorts just end up on the cutting room floor with us. Like, yeah, the riff bank is overflowing.
It's, I remember when we talked to, we had 4 Years Strong on a couple of months ago, and they were talking about how they wrote 50 songs for their last album. But then we also had Raging Speedhorn on, and they were talking about how they literally just write 10 songs and that's it. It's like, these are the 10, that's it. It's sort of varying the kind of, yeah, the way people approach it.
It's amazing the variation, isn't it? God, I wish we could do that. 10 songs in the studio. You know, it probably wouldn't take us 2.5 years.
Smash it out.
How do you approach the writing? I mean, obviously with this album in particular, there is quite an eclectic mix on there. I mean, for example, when I first put it on and had the first listen, I wasn't expecting the opener to be, you know, the intro's fairly, I don't know. Like, I feel like it's kind of like almost like a shoegaze influence in it.
Yeah.
How do you approach writing? Is it like a chief songwriter, or do you just bounce ideas off each other or get together and jam? Or
we all write in the room together. So basically how it works is Liam will come in with a few riffs that he's written. I'll write lead parts over them. Mark will, you know, do something absolutely insane on the drums. And that's basically how it works. Like, you know, if it's a meal, Liam's probably like the potatoes, you know, always there, the backbone. And I'm more like kind of, you know, the sauce and the decorations and all the bits that, like, you know, the garlic mayo. And
Mark. Excellent.
Is the meat or the fake meat, depending on your preference. Just sort of, you know, tying it all together, really. But like, yeah, we just, we argue all the time in a room and, yeah, just sort of bounce off each other, really. But I think by album 3, we'd really sort of found our, you know, sort of synergy and what works for us. Like, we couldn't be one of those bands that sits and records on a computer and emails it to each other. Like, it's not really how we tend to just bounce off each other in the room.
If this was Kerrang and we were interviewing you, 100% they would have like a massive picture of you guys and just the headline, "I am the garlic mayo." They love stuff like that.
In a feature they did with me a couple of years ago, the headline was, "I'm the Minnie Mouse of metal," which I quite liked.
It's different.
Yeah, I think the potato analogy is quite a good one for how a band works.
I hope the bandmates don't take offence. We can't all be the garlic mayo guys.
Come on, someone's got to be the potato.
Yeah.
I guess that's like what it sounds like when someone's having a bit of an ego trip in the studio. We're not all the garlic mayo guys, come on. Some of us have to be potatoes.
Speaking of interviews, though, it's a song on the new album called Clickbait. And the lyrics seem to kind of highlight your frustration with the media drawing upon your gender rather than just acknowledging that you're a vocalist and a guitarist. Is that something that happens often?
Yes. It tends to be with online metal publications.
Right.
They tend to be the worst, like the ones with the big followings. And yeah, everything that will be written about Svalbard will be, you know, the headline will say female fronted women, you know, this, that and the other, everything. But it's not just that it's highlighting the gender, it's that it highlights it in a particular way that almost makes it sound like there's a gender war in metal. The Clickbait was written specifically about a piece that was run on Metal Hammer Online a couple of years ago, and it was called something like women's voices have the most interesting voices in metal at the moment. But it was written in a kind of like, as if we were coming to steal the guys' jobs kind of thing, you know, that if we were women's presence posed a threat to men rather than standing alongside the guys and, you know, being in bands with the guys. And the headline was typically ambiguous in that it used the word voice, but it didn't allude to what it actually meant in the article, was like different opinions and perspectives in lyrics, but the way they used the word voice made it sound like vocals, which sparked a huge debate in the comments about whether women can do metal vocals and stuff. And I feel that that was like really deliberate, this kind of disengagement of the headline from the article to stoke to kind of that ambiguity is what causes the comments, and the comments are what causes the viral sharing and, you know, the ad revenue. And I've just noticed a bit of a pattern in the way that women are being written about, in that it's kind of there to stoke the trolls. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of... I could rant about this for ages. Clickbait's my favourite song on the album. It's basically our Get in the Ring by Guns N' Roses. It's our version of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you still see a kind of, if you look at like the big YouTube channels as well, I'm sure like every month on YouTube, the algorithm pulls up something based on my interest in music, and it'll be like top 10 female fronted bands or top 10 female vocalists. It kind of changes the playing field. It's like there's not two different types of bands here. These are similar bands, and there's no, you know, it just doesn't.
Yeah, just having a female in the band doesn't alter the genre or alter the songwriting or anything like that. Yeah.
Like it's some kind of like USP or a gimmick or something. It's just really weird. Yeah.
Well, that's the issue for me, is that it places my gender above everything else. You know, I'm not known as a guitarist. I'm not known as a vocalist. I'm known as a woman in a band, as if that should somehow change people's expectations of what my music is like. And the thing that also frustrated me in this particular article that our song Clickbait is about is the other women featured. I mean, they're all really talented, but it was bands like Murka, bands, you know, like Venom Prison, and they're all great, but I wouldn't say we sound anything like them at all. Like, there's not really any musical crossover. The only thing in common is that we're all women. And I feel that when you're kind of making that positive discrimination based on gender, the key word is still discrimination. And it's implying that we kind of, you know, like it's women's football, like we need our own league. We need our own separate category where, like, you know, none of us even sound alike. But one thing I would say is I think a lot of people seek the female fronted label because they think it's a good thing, and they'll say things like, oh, it helps me find and support women in music. And I can understand that mentality of people wanting to, you know, support, because women don't tend to be pushed to the front. You know, we don't tend to be like on the main stage at Down Low Festival or, you know, on the front pages of the magazines that often. And so people kind of make this judgment that there's fewer of us than there really is. And, you know, having things like, oh, a Facebook group where people can share female fronted bands, I think they think they're doing a good thing. So it's kind of, you know, I feel like I can't get too annoyed about it, but at the same time, like, it's just, it sucks to be reduced to your gender, you know?
Yeah. I did read a good interview with you the other day, but it was basically about people, you know, saying stuff online about, you know, females in metal, and you just kind of owning them basically. And there was one of the questions was something like, I can't remember what it was now, but it was something like all the, I can't remember the phrase now, but your answer is basically, oh, so you've listened to every single metal album of all time, have you? I wish I could remember the question now, but some of the responses on there were great. It was someone saying something about, like, of all the metal or something like that, and you're like, oh, you've listened to every single album, have you? Right, okay.
Yeah, I know the piece you're talking about, and that piece actually ties in with Clickbait. Response, because the article that Clickbait inspired got, so I think it got 1,500 comments, and I was getting like rape threats, I was getting death threats. Crazy people saying I should have been on the tour bus with Decapitated and all sorts of gross things. And because Jamila from the band Ithaca was also featured in the original piece, we then decided to respond to the worst comments. So we went to Metal Hammer and we picked out all the comments which we thought really needed addressing, and wrote a piece sort of like, you know, using our platform to say, do you realise how wrong you are, you know?
Yeah, that's the problem, is that you give someone a keyboard and an internet connection and everyone thinks that they're like the big man, but it's stupid.
I just don't get it. It's just, it's so bizarre, isn't it? For people who love this kind of music to kind of segregate it and tear it down in that way, it just makes no sense at all.
I think
metal is...
I was just gonna call them scumbags, but you can carry on.
That's all right. I feel it's welcome. Do you think metal itself is more misogynistic than other or pockets of metal are more misogynistic than other genres, or do you think it's just a case of, you know, the reflection of society that kind of exists across all types of music?
It's really interesting that you're asking me this, because up until recently I was studying for a PhD on this subject. So looking at misogyny and metal and saying, is it exclusive within the metal community, or is it a product of, you know, a misogynistic society, that kind of thing? What came first, you know? And I don't really... I think it's probably a bit of both. Like, you know, if you look at the history of metal has founding fathers. And that's a key phrase there. There's no founding mothers when people talk about the start of the metal scene. And then when you look at kind of the imagery of metal, it's always been kind of, you know, muscly guys and lots of like really almost cartoonish masculinity. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, everything that it represents is supposed to be tough and kind of, you know, unapproachable and stuff like that, and not soft in any way, shape or form, and angry and aggressive and things like that. And I think it's just the case of, you know, traditionally women aren't expected to show those kind of emotions. We're discouraged from it from a really young age. So if men see women in metal, some of them, I think, they don't like this kind of juxtaposition of feeling challenged by the presence of someone they would define as, you know, soft, girly, feminine. I think they believe that it weakens the aspect of metal, which, you know, is so prevalent of this masculinity. Like, but then I think this is basing it, I mean, it's a genre that's grown for so long over time, that surely it's got to like evolve now in 2020. Do you know what I mean? Like, surely. Yeah. The sort of the reflections of gender can only sort of become more diverse and get better in metal, I think. I don't know, it's just so crazy to me that like it's supposedly an outsider art, metal, and yet it is 90% white male dudes.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, yeah. And then going, you know, oh, we're so inclusive, but like, you know,
there's been similar responses to black men and women in metal bands as well. And the whole kind of, it's just the other, isn't it? And it's just, like you say, it's meant to be this outsider thing. And you would think as outsiders that people would be united in the fact that they're kind of misfits. And, you know, we're all coming from a place that's outside of the mainstream, but they're still infighting. And it's just, yeah, it's a strange, strange thing.
I think there's almost this myth that a lot of metalheads really uphold of it being this utopia, you know what I mean? And this is often you find the case with the guys. They'll be like, oh no, but you know, I got bullied at school, but then I went to these metal shows and everyone welcomed me like a brother with open arms. So, and then they'll challenge if I say, well, I didn't have that experience when I first started going to shows on my own. They'll say that it's me that's in the wrong, not that metal's in the wrong, because they can't possibly conceive that welcoming, you know, subgenre and community doesn't actually exist for everyone. It only exists for the people who fit the bill.
Yeah, it's kind of like the metal world is painted as this all welcoming subculture, if you want to call it that, but you could even boil it down to going to gigs. You know, it's supposed to be welcoming. There's always someone having fighting or someone being, you know, down the front and punching someone or whatever. So there's always going to be like these pockets of fools, aren't there?
It attracts the best and the worst people. That's the problem with metal.
Yeah,
that's definitely true. And there's a bit in one of our previous guests was Dan Franklin, who wrote a book called Heavy, which was the full title is Heavy: How Metal Changes the Way We See the World. It was out this year, I think. It's an interesting read, but there's this whole chapter in it about this kind of almost this mythical lore, the dragons and like Conan the Barbarian style figures with axes, and it's almost like, yeah, it's kind of the foundations in fantasy that have linked to metal are immensely masculine. They're kind of these warriors and these fighters, and you know, it's yeah, it's an interesting foundation to tie metal back to. But you're right in that you never think about the mothers of metal, the women of metal. It's always big dudes with muscles. It's us.
That's the template.
Yeah, as it is on this podcast. Well, aside from music then, I feel like we should maybe move on to something a bit more a bit more positive. Yeah. You're a bit of a roller coaster nerd.
I am, yes. I'm a staff member of the YouTube channel Coaster Force. We have 1.2 million subscribers. I basically get to travel all over the place, Europe, Japan, America, Canada, riding roller coasters. It's absolutely fantastic. It's like my biggest passion in life.
That's really cool.
And I just got back from a week-long trip in Germany, managed to squeeze that in before the sort of restrictions got a bit tighter. So that was really good. Six theme parks in 6 days. And yeah.
Wow. That's immense. Do you know how many times I've watched Coaster Force and I had no idea that, like...
Same. Yeah.
Really?
Because, I love, like, I'm not... I love roller coasters. I never, ever get... I rarely get to go to theme parks, but I love roller coasters. I love like point of view, like ride kind of videos.
And how have we never talked about this? Because I'm the same.
I don't know. We talked last time about how we watch other people's holiday videos, and like
that ties in with this really, because I was saying that last episode that I got hooked on this YouTube channel, these two guys, and it's pretty much all they do is they go to Disneyland. So they don't do POV stuff; they just walk around the park, but. Yeah, I mean, I went to Florida a couple of years ago, and I feel like I became like a bit of a theme park nerd then, and then just come back and just watch all these POV videos. But yeah, I've watched loads of Coaster Force. Do you get to do the POV videos or?
That's mostly the American fraction of things. I don't do the POVs. I do like the social media, and recently I did like an interview with the director of a theme park in Germany on the site of their brand new roller coaster. Mm. And all sorts of bits and pieces, writing trip reports and all sorts of stuff. I'm the person that organized, up until recently when we couldn't do them, the live meetups. So when people would, all meet up at a park and trundle around and get to like have exclusive ride time and stuff, that was me bringing all the nerds together. But yeah, I don't film the POV. No, that requires expensive equipment.
A GoPro with duct tape to your head.
And a lot of free time.
I might be going to Alton Towers the next few months because my son wants to go to Peppa Pig. No, not Peppa Pig Land, CBeebies Land. So if you need any like POV on the CBeebies rides, I can 100% do that. Oh, it might have a kid screaming in it, but we can edit it out.
It'll be you screaming.
Yeah, it probably will be me screaming.
So we want to know what your favourite roller coaster is then.
Okay, this is a hard question. It changed because I've got a top 10 and it
let's just do that then. You don't mind us digressing and talking about roller coasters, do you?
Absolutely not. It's my favorite subject. My number one roller coaster is called Phantom's Revenge at a park called Kennywood in Pennsylvania. It's just absolutely bonkers. It's the only coaster in the world where the second drop is taller than the first drop. So you go up, 200 foot, do your big drop, and then you go up and then you dive off a ravine, like straight down.
Nice.
And I love it. I mean, it's not the most extreme roller coaster in the world, but it's one of those ones where you go on, you come off buzzing, and you just run round and just keep going on. And that's like something I look for personally in a coaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another one I really like is a coaster called Flushbon Novgorod at Hansa Park. It's got a launch, it's got a beyond vertical drop, it's all themed to like a Russian curse, and it's like the most black metal ride.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's like Vikings singing and like all these crows, and it's really dark, and I like the sort of dark theme, and it's just one of those coasters that like its layout is really unique and interesting. So it doesn't sort of ride like a standard one. You sort of spend the whole time being surprised, going, what's going to happen next? Just trying to think. There's a coaster called Hakugai in Nagashima Spa Land in Japan that used to be a huge wooden roller coaster, but then they converted it and put steel tracks on top.
I think I've seen that one.
The POV of me riding that, because I've done a few TV shows about roller coasters, and I did one while I was in Japan, and there's a video of me, like my reaction to this ride, which is quite funny. Yeah, it's huge and it's amazing, loads of airtime and stuff. Another one of my favorites is one you might have ridden, Mako at SeaWorld in Florida. Did you go to SeaWorld?
I didn't go to SeaWorld, but only because I'm an annoying vegan who was a bit against the whipping of the manatees and the sacrificing of the whales and all that.
But
I've seen the POVs of it. It does look pretty good because that was VR for a bit, wasn't it?
Oh no, that was Kraken that was VR.
Oh god, I'm showing myself up here.
Kieran, honestly, you embarrass me every time.
Mako's the huge purple one, the hyper coaster. It's really, really tall. You can see it from like International Drive. But yeah, I can understand people's negative feelings towards SeaWorld. It's kind of annoying that they've got such a good coaster now. But you know, to be fair, Blackfish made them change their ways a lot. So they have stopped the orca shows now, and they have stopped breeding them. And they do like a sort of welfare program for manatees and things now. So like,
oh, cool.
You know, I think with all things in life, you've got to let people get better. And as a company, I think SeaWorld are improving, which is good. You know, they haven't just sort of taken something like Blackfish and gone, yeah, it doesn't matter, we're going to plow ahead. Like I think they're realizing the error of their ways and growing from that.
Yeah. I remember finding a place that did this. I was talking to you about this, Graham, wasn't it? It's Mellow Mushroom, isn't it? That's what it's called.
Yeah.
The pizza place, finding one of them on, I think it was just off International Drive and sitting and eating a vegan pizza, and you could see the roller coaster overlooking it. It was cool.
Like, how have we never talked about this before? I'm sure we must have tried to talk about this before.
I tried to open up a conversation about it.
Didn't I tell you recently that I watched like an hour-long documentary? No, I watched like an hour-long documentary about the building of the Ultimate at Lightwater Valley.
Oh!
Because I'm from the Northeast. My accent's like completely disappeared. But we used to go to Lightwater Valley all the time. And I remember, like, and still to this day, like, the Ultimate is one of my favorite roller coasters. Just it's crackers. It's so long.
Yeah.
And it's just in the middle of nowhere. There's no park around it. There's no roads around it. It feels like you're going through a forest. It's absolutely bizarre.
It's like one of those roller coasters that actually feels like an expedition, doesn't it? Like,
yeah,
you're
totally.
Like 4 miles away from everything when you're on it.
Totally.
Yeah, it's really good. One of the best in the UK, I think, the Ultimate. There's a bit of a hidden gem.
So I remember when I was a kid. Yeah, totally. And I was like, I think the first time I went on it, when you said like it is in the middle of nowhere, I remember as a kid thinking, if this thing like goes wrong, we are fucked, because like the nearest ambulance is never going to get over this grass. It was really like, because like that, you go kind of go over that first, there's that first drop, and then there's kind of all these little kind of little bumpy bits leading up to a second drop, and then that kind of goes through just the woods, but it goes on for ages. I'm sure at one point it was like the longest roller coaster in Europe.
Yes, yeah, I believe it may still hold that title of the longest in, it's definitely the longest in the UK. But yeah, it absolutely goes on for miles, the Ultimate. It's really good. Did you go to Flamingoland as well?
Yeah, we used to go there all the time as well. The Corkscrew and Thunder Mountain, which was obviously a rip-off of Space Mountain at Disney. They had some good rides too, yeah.
I actually think that the most terrifying ride I've ever been on is It's a Small World at Disneyland. Not because, you know, it's an adrenaline rush or anything, but just because you've got all these weird, creepy dolls from all over the world just singing the same song at you over and over again for 10 minutes. Still have nightmares about that.
There's something about animatronics that's quite, unsettling.
Yeah. To a roller coaster nerd, if you're to say, oh, yeah, I went to Disneyland and I went to Universal Studios and all the rides are amazing, is that like something like when you're a proper roller coaster nerd, you don't go to those places, you find like the really cool places like Knott's Berry Farm and all that? Have I just done like the equivalent of saying, yeah, I'm really, really into like underground punk music like Blink-182 and Green Day?
I mean, I like the first album, but...
I guess the thing would be is that Disney and Universal is everyone's, you know, experience of theme parks. So it's the ones that everyone knows and experiences, but they're also, you know, they're that way for a reason, because they are the best, some of the best in the world.
Yeah.
And you get, I would say, the majority of like people on Coaster Force and stuff absolutely love the Disney parks and Disney World and the Universal rides. So it's not, you know, it's not really the same thing as, like, you know, saying something super, super obvious and things. I think you can love coasters and have only been to those parks. It just depends how much your hunger takes you to, like, other places. Like, I'm a big fan of the parks in Japan. There's Disneyland in Japan as well, and that's really good.
Me and my wife, we've done a couple of them now, and we because she's a massive Disney nerd, so we were like, let's try and go to every single one, every single Disney park. But
that's the thing, is like Disney World has the not necessarily theme park enthusiasts, but Disney enthusiasts.
Yeah,
very different thing. They have their own kind of following and people who love Disney. Whereas for me, I can enjoy a Disney park, but I'd say I'm more of a theme park enthusiast. Because Disney it caters to like a younger audience, I guess I'd say.
And some crazy people.
Yes.
she used to work for Disney. So she's really into it. But we met someone there. We actually went on Halloween night, which is pretty cool. Oh. And there was someone dressed up. We got talking to this girl dressed up as Alice from Alice in Wonderland. But she was talking to us as if she was Alice from Alice in Wonderland. And it was just a bit weird. We were talking to her and then she was like, I'm going to go meet Mickey and stuff. And then she met Mickey Mouse.
And killed him.
But then she was talking to... Yeah. And she was talking to him like she was the actual character. And I thought that was a bit weird, so...
Wow. Yeah, that's... it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Have you been to the... what's the one at Universal Studios called during Halloween?
Halloween Horror Night. I was meant to go this year.
Oh, so no.
It's a very sore subject. It's been my bucket list for ages because I go to all the other Halloween. I'm a big fan of all the Halloween stuff at theme parks. I did quite a bit of it out in Germany last week. And Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Florida is the, you know, sort of creme de la creme of their events. But
that was hands down one of the best things I've ever done. That it was just crazy. You're just walking along and then someone runs at you with a chainsaw.
Would it be terrifying if you were like 10 years old, because that's how old I think my wife was when she went. My wife's American and she lives in South Carolina, so they'd always go to Florida to go and stuff, and I'm pretty sure her parents I'm pretty sure her parents took her to the Halloween night at Universal when she was about 10-11 years old, and she just said a scarter for life.
Yeah, it would be absolutely terrifying. I mean, normally these things have age restrictions. Like, normally I think the one at Thorpe Park is like 15 and up kind of thing. I would say like that's a very young age.
Maybe she was 15. I hope she was.
Well, speaking of Thorpe Park and Halloween, you did the music for the... Was it this year? Was it last year? Was it both years?
It's both years. Yeah. So I did the music for Creek Freak Massacre, the scare attraction at Fright Nights at Thorpe Park. Last year it was an indoor scare maze, and it was the best time ever when I was writing it. It took me 6 months to write the soundtrack. It's 2 hours of music, and I had the entire lookbook and all these photos of what they were building. I used to get to go down and go like in the build area with my hard hat on and my steel toe caps and look at, you know, how it was all getting laid out and where the speaker placement was going to be and what sounds were going to be in each room and stuff. But the kitchen. Wow. At the time I lived with Liam from Svalbard, and the kitchen where I did use like my audio workstation and stuff was just plastered in these photos of, like, because the theme is chainsaws, kind of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was just like plastered in these pictures of like cut up bodies and like people with chainsaws and stuff. So I did the soundtrack for that. I'm like super happy with how it came out. And then this year, because of COVID, they didn't do the indoor attraction, but they've made a whole scare zone called Creek Freaks Unchained, and I went there on Wednesday to check it out, and it was absolutely brilliant. Obviously my music was like pumping out all over the park, and it's a bit of a dream come true for me. I'd love to do more of that in the future.
I was going to say, if you're a roller coaster nerd, that must have just been an amazing feeling to go there and see something, hear something you've created.
Absolutely.
But it's crazy, like, you know, how much detail goes on behind the scenes, isn't it, really? And how much work goes into it. It's not just a case of, you know, putting a few cobwebs and a few fake spiders up or something. There's like, people are so into it now, aren't they?
It's an art form, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. for a lot of of people, it is their full-time job planning these events, you know, just for 1 month of the year. There's a lot of documentaries on it on Amazon. There's one called Haunters, The Art of the Scare, and it sort of explores how people build these contraptions and stuff. But yeah, to me, I think of it as art, you know.
Yeah. Have you seen is it an American Scream? Is that what it's called? The documentary following the three families who are building their attractions on in their houses for Halloween, and the kind of dedication that, oh my God, and the kids and the mum just being like, why are you doing this? And it was like the 3rd of November, and he's already got like the animatronics out and he's trying to get them all working again. It's crackers.
Yeah. Crackers.
I remember seeing that Macame Manor as well on YouTube, which, yeah, that looks intense. Would you ever give that a go?
I have a theory about Macame Manor. I think it's all actors, and I think it's a YouTube thing because none of them swear. And I just think if you were in that situation and you had, you know, people force feeding you spiders or waterboarding you and all these kind of torture simulation things, and not any of them swear, or when you're, if you watch a full video of it, and he'll be going, Russ, the main guy who does it, will be saying, look at the camera, look over here, look at that, and they do it and they follow the instructions.
Yeah.
I just think, knowing what America's like with all the lawyers, and I know they make them sign disclaimers and stuff,
yeah,
I just feel that there's something that doesn't quite add up as to why it hasn't been shut down yet. And I think it's all like the people who go through it are actors.
Do you know what? Now you've said it. Yeah. Now I can kind of see what you mean. Yeah. Have you seen this, Graham?
I haven't. No, I'm kind of sat here thinking, this sounds absolutely terrible, but...
Yeah, it's like, well, if it is real, then the idea is this guy has built this kind of haunted house experience, but I think it goes on for like 8 hours, supposedly, or something ridiculous, doesn't it? And you have to sign this waiver before you go in. And it's, I'll send you, we can look it up on YouTube after this. It looks terrifying, but yeah, maybe it is fake.
It'll be an evening wasted if you start researching. Well, not wasted. It'll be an evening that you can consume yourself with looking at the manor and stuff, because like it's just a YouTube rabbit hole. But in regard to this, I have actually, because Macame Manor's not the only one that does this kind of thing, I have done extreme scare attractions where you have to sign a waiver and you have to be 18. Mm. I did one in the Netherlands called The Clinic at a theme park called Wallaby Holland. And you're completely like bound to a bed and they bury you alive. It was quite horrible. And then I did one, Thorpe Park used to do one called Face It Alone, which did get, banned after a few years. And again, it was 18, sign a waiver, go through on your own. But their one was very physical, like you get sort of whipped and hair pulled out and all sorts of things.
Wow.
Like lots of nudity and things like that. And I quite like that one. Like it was.
That is hardcore.
You come out and you sort of go, oh my God, that was like the most intense 5 minutes of my life. But like, you know, it's one
and
of
I was just. I was just about to say that like 2.8 hours later that I did in 2013, I think it was pretty wild. But that does not, like, I didn't get my hair pulled out and I definitely didn't get buried alive or whipped or anything. So
yeah, I was scared enough going into the Stranger Things house Universal. Yeah. So I don't know whether that's me. But yeah, we queued for that for we got there and we thought we could go on that straight away. There wasn't that much of a queue, and then we decided to go on the Harry Potter ride, and then we thought we'll go on Stranger Things later when it's calmed down, and then at 11 o'clock at night the queue was still 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
So we were like, we're just gonna have to get on with it, and like my feet were just in agony. Like we walked out at the end and I thought I was just gonna like collapse and need to go to the hospital or something. We've been stood up for that long, but it was well worth it.
I think that's the thing with Halloween Horror Nights at Universal, it does get insanely busy, so
yeah.
Like you've got to be quite, I'm probably no fun to go to theme parks with, because I'll like plan my route and we're going to do this in this order and, you know, go for these ones to minimize the amount of queuing you do. I think the thing with Halloween Horror Nights and like the Stranger Things like stuff, it looks like super theatrical and super immersive, but nothing in that looks like it would scare me, if you know what I mean. It just looks like really, you know,
all right, okay,
impressive. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really scared. I was just saying that just for like the interview purposes. I couldn't bother me.
So you didn't Did you ever hear about 2.8 hours later, Kieran?
No.
So this was back in, like, it kind of ties into this a little bit. I think this was back about 7 or 8 years ago, maybe a bit further. And the first year they did it, it was absolutely incredible. I went to one after, the year after, and it wasn't as good. I think the hype had taken over a bit. But basically, it was an event you signed up for in Manchester, and you got split up into teams of like 4 or 5. And the idea was that, you know, there'd been a kind of zombie outbreak, and the undead were roaming the streets. And it very cleverly, it happened in the city itself.
It sounds a little bit like Manchester is now on a daily basis. The undead walking the streets.
But they used like real actors and kind of, you know, like really convincing people who just come up to you in the street and tell you their wife's missing, give you a picture of her and stuff. And then the idea was you had to kind of go through these different venues and outrun the zombies. If you got tagged with by one of the zombies with a UV marker, you get scanned at the end. And if you had a tag on you, you could see if you failed. And if you did fail, you got turned into a zombie for like a disco that happened afterwards. But it was so clever because at the time there was this huge building boom in Manchester. And they used, like, I think one of the ones we went into was upstairs, probably like the 15th, 16th floor of this high rise, with this single desk in the middle of this massive room and a guy just with his head on the desk. And we had to go through the door behind him. And the way they kind of utilized these spaces, there was an old church where there was a lady tied up in the corner who was trying to grab you. There was a bar that had been recently shut down, and this zombie vaults over the bar. It was terrifying, but it was so much fun. And I think that's the kind of thing, looking at a lot of these videos of what they do now, like, there has to be like a good balance, I imagine, between being scared and laughing your head off while being scared.
I do like how Serena's talking about having like hair pulled out and all that. And you're like, I went to this one and you get a UV stamp and you go to a disco afterwards.
Yeah, man. It was family friendly.
You could take Logan there. I feel like we should talk a bit more about music.
Yeah, we could.
Or should we just sack that off?
I'm assuming that the music that you wrote for the Halloween thing at Thought Park, I'm assuming that is very different to Svalbard. It wasn't lots of blast beats and growling. And
oh, there is. It's quite heavy in places because right. They wanted like a sort of more metal vibe, but it's okay. More, I'd say, like kind of, so yeah, there's like doomy atmospheric bits, sort of droney bits, a lot of like soundscapey stuff with noise and like, you know, me doing all sorts of crazy, weird stuff with vocals and then eerie kind of, more traditional soundtracky bits, like using the kind of it's super nerdy. I went round the park and sampled all of the like classic roller coaster sounds at Thought Park. So like the sound of a train coming off a lift hill, the sound of stealth's launch fins retracting, and then I sampled them all and like put them through oscillators and like detuned them and things like that. To create like that sort of uncanny valley familiarity of Thought Park sounds, but they were being used in a different way. And I did the same thing with their normal theme tune. I like played it on guitar, but like detuned my guitar as I was playing it, so it just sounds wrong. It's horrible. But yeah, it's kind of it's not like you know, it's not like a computer game soundtrack or anything. It's still guitar based and quite heavy, but it's not like Svalbard. It's a lot dirtier, I guess, like rough and you know. I guess that's how I'd describe it.
Like I say, we talked about that, you know, the new album, and that's quite eclectic. You must have quite a lot of influences outside metal as well.
Yeah, well, I am mostly influenced musically by soundtracks, like gaming soundtracks. My favourite music of all time is the Skyrim soundtrack.
Oh, cool.
All the time. And yeah, just other sort of RPG soundtracks, basically, or like good film scores or classical are like the big influences on me. And when I'm writing guitar leads, that's the same kind of feeling that I go for, just how evocative, like, the main theme of Skyrim just makes you feel so many things. And that's the thing I'm searching for when I write. I don't necessarily sit there and go, I want to write a riff that sounds like, I don't know, Satyricon or something like. Yeah, it's mostly like more melodic soundtracky stuff that I really like.
It's probably quite a good way of writing, because it's, you know, soundtrack stuff, it's all designed to create an emotion, isn't it? So I suppose, even, you know, for writing from a band point of view, it's a really good place to start.
Yeah, definitely. Like, we're all about that, you know, making people feel something as a band.
Yeah. I was watching
Skyrim.
Oh, go on.
No, go ahead, mate. It's fine.
You said the magic word, Skyrim.
Oh yeah, I feel like you should go first. I've not even played Skyrim and I
do, you know,
I like Disneyland, so
I'm not an RPG person, unfortunately. It's so stupid even saying that. A kind of story-based game person, that's exactly what an RPG is. What I mean is I tend to kind of...
Like Sudoku.
Yeah. I tend to kind of like action-adventure games that have really strong stories. I unfortunately do not have... Oh, I wish I had the time to really get into... you know, I played Fallout 4 a lot and stuff, but I don't have the time to kind of grind into RPGs. But would Skyrim be your favourite video game soundtrack? Are there any others that you think just... blow you away?
The Fable one's really good as well. The Dark Souls soundtrack's really good. There's absolutely loads. I could list them all off. Skyrim's my favourite, but also Skyrim is my favourite game. So
right.
There's, you know, probably a bias there. Also, oh God, the Final Fantasy soundtracks. So cool. And they do the piano versions or like the orchestral versions. You can get a whole album of just like piano versions of Final Fantasy music, and it's just the best thing ever. It's so beautiful. Like, yeah,
I know that I've heard the Final Fantasy ones, these really big kind of expansive soundtracks. I feel a bit dumb now, because one of my favorite soundtracks, I think I sent Kieran the first song of it a few probably a couple of years ago when it came out, was the remake of Doom.
Oh yeah,
Mick Gordon's soundtrack for that is absolutely insane. But it's very kind of...
I think everyone can agree that the Doom soundtrack is awesome.
Oh, it's iconic, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember playing that out the PA at the Ritz in Manchester last year. Someone put it on. It was just like blew your head off, and it was cool.
Rip and tear. Not a good game soundtrack per se, but I've been replaying Grand Theft Auto 5, and the radio station choices in that game are absolutely fantastic, especially the country station. Love the country station.
Is that the one that's got Stevie Winwood on?
I think is that the Los Santos Rock station? I can't remember, but there's so many good like radio stations.
You totally know. You know the track listings, don't you, geek?
I know. I just love that. GTA 5 is like, I don't know. It's my favourite, probably favourite game of all time. I love it.
We've really digressed here, but
we've really gone off, haven't we? Massively off tangent. I wanted to ask actually about some promo shots that you guys have done. I noticed this. I've noticed this a couple of times. Do you have a deliberate preference for having press or promo shots done that involve you eating food? Because I've seen one with ice creams and I've seen one with donuts, and I'm trying to find like a third one, but they're both amazing like sets of photos. And I just wondered if that was a deliberate kind of, you know, let's have a certain like dessert themed set of promo shots, or is that just naturally kind of happened?
It's not deliberate, but now that people are picking up on it, I think we might start to just, you know,
keep
rolling with it. I think the thing is like doing photo shoots, no one really talks about this in the band, are really awkward, and like you don't really know what to do with yourself, and you don't really know what to do with your hands. And if there's basically how it turned out the first time with the donuts was, we were doing some photos in Manchester, and our PR person Becky Laverty turned up with a load of vegan donuts, and we were just sort of scoffing them, and then did some photos at the same time, and they came out quite good. And then I think with the ice cream one this year, it was sort of, I did suggest it because I was there thinking, well, if we're eating, we've got something to do with our hands. There's, you know, there's something a bit more human about it, I think, because like it's really hard to do a band photo shot and not look like cliche, you know what I mean? Not stand there with your arms folded, or like stand there doing the horns, or you know, flipping the camera off or whatever it is. It's like, you know, it's really hard to have a bit of personality in a photo without looking like cliched. So food was the way we went, I guess, with that.
I suppose you've got to make a choice, haven't you, between do I try and look serious and pull it off, or do I try and be daft and try and pull it off? As long as you stood in like an abandoned warehouse somewhere, then as a, you know, as a heavy band, you know it's going to be fine.
I realised as time has gone on, I definitely prefer a bit of a goofy look for us as a band, because we're not the cool kids and we're not tough. And sometimes I look back on photo shoots where you've been doing certain things because magazines like certain things, and you look back and you go, oh God, like we don't act like that. We don't look like that. Like that's really kind of disingenuous to our personalities. So, nowadays I'm all about the kind of just have a silly photo, because, you know, it doesn't matter, does it?
And there's probably that thing as well, isn't there, that because the music is heavy and intense, that the kind of the band somehow is forced into representing that as individuals, when that isn't really the case. I mean, I'm sure you don't go around all the time like with your hands in your pockets looking furious. That's not a representation of an individual.
No, exactly. That's it. And it's this weird thing of like, you've got to kind of visually interpret your music and your sounds. And like, I remember sort of doing photo shoots and people saying, oh, you know, think about how this song makes you feel. Imagine I'm this song's written about. And yeah, you do. You'll be like growling at the camera, like making fists and like, oh, I'm going to fight you kind of thing. And it's like, that's not me. I've never fought anyone in my life. Like, you know, I wish there was a bit more kind of lenience with, you know, metal sometimes, to just kind of...
Yeah, I suppose you have to nominate one person to be stood, one person to be crouched down, one person to have their arms folded.
Yeah.
And there's always one person as well with one foot against a wall looking up at the sky. There's that one too.
Yeah.
We should get into band photography. We'd make a fortune.
We should, mate. And videography. There was that video on YouTube or something recently about, like, there's only three kinds of metal videos, and one was the abandoned warehouse. Mm-hmm. The other one was the sparse room with, like, a couple of different lighting rigs around it, and the lights kind of change and strobe. I can't remember what the third one was, but I was like, oh, no.
No, it's fine. It's good.
Strike one.
No, it's fine.
That video is a bit different, though, because there's a lot of... I sound like I'm digging a hole. I'm not even being... Yeah, it's fine. It's a good video anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Whatever it is, it's got to be better than the early 2000s pop punk kind of emo phase, where it was always in some suburban American neighborhood or in an abandoned swimming pool with people on the side skateboarding. Yeah,
they were the best.
Yeah, good times. Should we move on some fan questions?
Oh, yeah, okay.
I'll let you go first, G-Man.
Okay. Though, I don't know if that's actually how you pronounce this. Just to say as well, last week we had, previous, not the last guest we had, but the previous one was Sten from a band, Brutus, and a lot of the usernames were Dutch or French, and we absolutely butchered every single one of them. So I was telling myself I'm going to make a conscious effort this time to be so much better, and now I'm looking at this name and I'm like, I think that's how it's pronounced.
Listen, we got the album name right, so we're all right, don't worry about it.
We did.
So Sivo asks, at what point did you realise you could roar like that? What does it take to try and make that sound with your voice? And did it take time to learn how to do that without damaging your voice?
Oh, I think I first started trying to do metal vocals when I started listening to Slipknot, when I was about sort of 12, 13. And I guess you're fascinated by it, because when you first hear metal, it's a sound that no one ever sounds like that before. I remember like first hearing it and going, oh my God, that must be the angriest man in the world. Wow, he's so furious. And then you kind of realize it's just a vocal style. And I used to sit there in my room. I used to walk home from school really, really fast to get home before my sister, so that I could like do some screaming for like 5 minutes before. And, you know, you'd be there trying to screaming into a pillow so that the neighbors couldn't hear. and waiting to hear the key in the door that was my sister, so I'd have to immediately stop kind of thing. But yeah, that was like, I started when I was an early teenager, and I think before, I used to misinterpret that you really had to go all out all the time. And when I started joining bands when I was like 16, I used to blow my voice out at every practice because I was literally screaming at full, you know, pelt the whole way through, which isn't actually how you do it. And then I guess I honed my technique over time. Before I was in Svalbard, I was in a black metal band, which doing the higher pitched black metal screams really destroys your voice. And we, when we were on tour, I sort of had to learn to, that was when I learned to like rein it in and control a bit. And then the biggest thing for me that's improved my vocals now is going swimming regularly, because it's forced me to like learn how to control my breathing, which is what I do on stage to get through the set, basically, and to get through a 2-week tour without losing my voice. So yeah, swimming and screaming into a pillow at age 12.
So if you want to be the Garlic Mayo in a metal band, make sure you go swimming regularly.
Yeah, that's it. That's the lesson. Yeah. I had my dad was around a few months ago, and we were watching, I can't remember what we were watching.
Is he in a metal band?
My dad, no. My dad's seen 2 gigs in his life, but one of them was Motorhead, so.
So he's deaf. Second, so loud.
Yes, I forget what the second one was. But we were watching, I had something on YouTube in the background, and it was, I can't remember which band it was. And my dad was just like, that must bloody hurt. It must hurt your voice. That must bloody hurt. And I think it's about, there's a technique, isn't there? There must be, because there must be, I don't know, how do you make it sound as intense without doing yourself any damage? What is used to stop that from happening?
I'll be honest with you, it does hurt. And like my voice is sore at the moment because we have rehearsal.
Dad was right.
Yeah, it does hurt. Your dad is absolutely spot on there. My voice is sore today because we have rehearsal yesterday, and you know, it does take its toll. I think it's about finding that comfort zone of what you're okay with. Mm-hmm. So like now I tend to stick to lower screams. I'm definitely like can get a lot more power in that without feeling the pain in your throat, whereas the higher pitched I go, the harder it gets. And I've been recording a solo black metal record over lockdown and doing those black metal vocals again. I was like, oh my god, this, you know, this is so painful. Definitely won't be able to tour that.
that's up next year, isn't it?
Yes.
That right? That'll be interesting, because there's quite a lot of before we answer the next question, I'm just going to hog it again. There's obviously quite a lot of kind of black metal influence in Svalbard. It's you can hear a bit more of that, I think, coming into this album as well. So you've obviously decided to do something on your own outside of Svalbard that uses that.
Yeah, I mean, if it were my way, if I got to be like the musical dictator of Svalbard, we would be a black metal band. The rest of the guys bring the more kind of D-beat crust, melodic hardcore style to the band, which isn't really my forte. And then I'm from the sort of more black metal sphere, and that's the thing I bring. But yeah, so when lockdown began, I was like, right, now's the time, just do the pure 100%. Well, it's kind of progressive black metal, and it's been really nice to like, yeah, just get stuck in with that again.
Do you know what, on the new album there's some seriously good D-beat moments on that, which have just been loads of fun while I'm cooking dinner, air drumming along to Alexa.
Pasta everywhere.
yeah. Tiny, tiny milks, it's all on the floor. At least the dog's eating it. Anyway, Stephen W. Payne, we obviously won't go too much into the backstory behind this, but Stephen W. Payne asks, now that a few weeks have passed, what are your thoughts and feelings towards Holy Raw?
My thoughts and feelings about everything that happened with Holy Raw, because I think a key thing to establish is that it was one person from Holy Raw who had these allegations of sexual abuse made against him. And Holy Raw was 4 members of staff, and the other members of staff, Justine, Sam and Will, all left and all stood in solidarity with the victims. And obviously Justine since then has been working with us to release our album on Church Row Records that she runs with her husband Sammy. And so I think 3 out of 4, you know, on Holy Raw, the staff at Holy Raw are, you know, absolutely fantastic and, you know, fantastic people. And I would hate to see their names get tarnished because the Holy War brand is now, you know, it can't really continue, can it? It's damaged. Mm-hmm. And overall, in terms of like reflecting about the whole thing, I mean, we're a band who sing about sexual abuse and sexual assault. We've got songs all about kind of protecting women in these situations. So it was like, as soon as I was made aware of these allegations, it was absolutely like a no-brainer for us as a band that we had to leave the label as quickly as possible. So it was a case of, you know, basically doing that. And to be completely honest with you, leaving Holy Roar 3 weeks before our album was due to be released on them did damage our album release. It's not available in the shops at the moment. And, you know, all sorts of things with press. People were wanting to pull their press and their reviews and stuff like that because they didn't want to be seen as associating with Holy Roar bands. So, like, you know, it was a move that, you know, wasn't necessarily... It did affect our album. I sort of feel like the timing of it, we bore the brunt of it, but then I wouldn't want to sit here and make it all about us and how it affected us, because the main thing is that the victims know we sort of stand in solidarity with them and, you know, won't work with anyone who has that kind of reputation.
Yeah, well, yeah, we don't need to go into much more about Holy Roar, but, you know, it's good the album's made it out. And, next question.
Okay, the Apocalyptic Triumph asks, who did the artwork for your last album?
It was a guy called Stephen Kingscote, who is not on social media because he hates the world, and he is a guy an artist not on Instagram. Like, what? Do they even exist?
DM me for collab.
He works in the studio that we rehearse in, and we became aware of his artistic skills when he started drawing members of Svalbard as dogs. So we've got a really fantastic little drawing of Liam with like little Jack Russell ears and everything.
Nice.
And he's still yet to do me as a dog, which, you know, that's my main bugbear with Stephen. But he did the artwork for It's Hard to Have Hope, and we went back to him for the new album because we feel he did a fantastic job. He's really good, but unfortunately there's nowhere online where you can see his work.
Yeah, that just makes it extra cool.
I just want to know as well how the dog thing came about. Like, did you just get like an email one day that was just like, subject dog, and you open it and it's like just drawings of you guys as dogs?
Subject dog.
Well, we were rehearsing in the studio and dogs. We were rehearsing in the studio and he was behind the counter, you know, doing the sort of taking the payments and doing all the studio admin, making the teas. And, you know, we always chat to him. We've sort of become good friends with him at the studio. And as we were going to leave, he just showed us the picture of Svalbard as dogs.
Daniel Picata did some of your earlier artwork, I believe, didn't he?
Is that a dog there?
It is a dog right there. I have a greyhound.
Oh, I want a greyhound. What's his name?
She's a big cat.
Oh.
Kieran has a dog too. He's got an energetic little lad, haven't you?
Yeah, he's very young. He's like 10 months and now I'm working from home, obviously, with everything. He's just a nightmare. He's trying to do work and he's just sat there going like this on you all the time. Yeah, I had to tell him off today because we're training him off his lead and then he wouldn't get back off his lead in this field. So we had words, but yeah, I came back and had a bite to eat and then we made up. So it's all right now, just if you were concerned. But
yeah. I still regularly chuckle about the day that I found out, because you were... obviously, as I have, we're adopting a dog. And you kind of didn't know when it was going to happen. And I got a text of you. I remember getting a text of you. Oh, we've got a dog. We've got to go and pick it up now. I've got to go to the shop to buy stuff. You had like nothing for this dog.
It got delivered. So basically, I mentioned this charity before, actually. I'm going to mention them again, a name drop. A charity called Muffin Pugs. And they rescue pugs. They're absolutely amazing. They fly out to China. They fly out to Egypt. And they rescue these pugs and bring them back. So we signed up to adopt one, but they say they have to obviously match you to one. And then, we got a phone call one day saying, we've got a dog, would you like it? And we're like, we're in lockdown. Can we go to Pets at Home and get a bed or what? And like 2 hours later, they just turned up with a dog. So I joked that it's like Amazon Prime, but with dogs. So you just turned up on your doorstep. Oh, do you know what though? I mentioned lockdown. We nearly made it to the end without talking about lockdown. Oh. We've not done that so far.
Oh. We've not. Never mind. There's always next time.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just saying on the subject of artwork, yeah, Daniel Picard did some of your earlier artwork, I believe, which is really cool. So how does one hire Daniel Picard as a graphic designer?
That came about through, that was a split we did with the band Pariso.
Yeah.
And some of Pariso are friends with Daniel Picard, so that was how it came about, friends helping each other out, I guess. But yeah, it's really surreal to me because like I'm a huge fan of his artwork and he's done artwork for us. Like that's crazy to me.
I'm sure
you probably can like email him and see how much he'd charge and stuff to do artwork. I'm sure he's probably like, you know, open to bands, doing stuff for bands. But yeah, I wouldn't want to guess how much he charges.
We need a new logo. Let's go on it.
Yeah, for Kieran's Christmas present, I'm going to email him and ask him to draw Kieran as a dog. See how much he charges.
That'll be a nice cheap Christmas for you.
Yeah.
Okay, next question. Z3D Black. Zed Black? Whatever it is. Have you ever considered doing a power metal album?
If I could play well enough, I would absolutely do a power metal album because power metal is my favourite genre of music.
Nice.
But I don't have the skills, unfortunately. I can't really do all the tapping and I can't sing in the power metal way and my drumming is pretty ropey at best. So there's just nothing that I could bring to a power metal band creatively that would make it anywhere near the greats that we have today. So yeah, sadly, no, I wouldn't, but I do. It's my main thing that I love to listen to.
Could you not just record the guitar solos at half speed and then speed them up to twice as speed and release that?
Think of that. Yeah, could give that a go.
And just call it a lockdown album and just say you can't tour off it.
Nice. Okay, last one. I think this is Chucky X. I'm pretty sure the V is a U. Would Svalbard ever take their music in a more sludgy direction? Sorry, I'm just going to start that again. Chucky X says, would Svalbard ever take their music in a more sludgy direction? Slow Svalbard.
Oh!
Exclamation mark.
Svalbard. Yeah. Probably not. We've got a few slow songs here and there. There's a few slower songs on the first album and stuff. We do like a good ballad. But in terms of like sludgy and kind of stonery, groovy, heavy kind of thing, that's not really my forte playing wise. I can trem pick or nothing. So I probably wouldn't be able to do that. I'm sure Mark listens to a lot of that kind of sludgy stuff. So he'd probably love to do more stuff like that. But I think collectively it wouldn't be our strength. So it's probably not something we'd dabble in too much, but you never know. Like when we get older, we might just naturally get slower.
Would you not take the material written for the power metal album and just slow that down to half the speed? And then you've got like two albums for the price of one, call it a double album, whatever.
There we go.
Sweet.
Money in the bank.
if you're looking for a new manager, by the way, you know, I'm available. I've got great advice.
I just wanted to ask as well before we go. Today is Sunday. We're recording this on a Sunday, and every Sunday, me and Kieran do this thing on Instagram and across social called Shameless Sunday, where we just talk about a song that we love, that is just the least metal song ever. And we do it kind of because, you know, we don't want to be,
because we're edgy,
pigeonholed as only liking one type of music. It's not the case. So today, Kieran, what did you choose today, Kieran?
I chose, you might not have heard of Rita Ora and Liam Payne. I think it was in One Direction. Small up-and-coming artist. Oh, no, Joe, I love this tune so much. It's called For You, and it's off the 50 Shades of Grey soundtrack. Honestly, I love it so much. It's such a good tune.
But I was just wondering what's your, I don't want to say guilty pleasure, because I think that's a bit of a, a loaded term. You either like something or you don't. What's your favourite song that people might be surprised that you like?
Oh, that's a really hard question. I listen to loads of pop. Big, you know, that's my like gym music or my walking really fast when I'm late to work music. Love some well-produced pop. Mm-hmm. In terms of Rita Ora, all we listen to in the van when we're driving to and from shows is basically pop as well. And Radioactive by Rita Ora, that's our favourite, which was actually written by Sia, which is why it's good, because she's such a great songwriter. I would probably say, I guess, like the cheesiest stuff. I'm really big into my Eurovision. And I do like, you know, Charlotte Nilsson's win for Sweden in 1999 with Take Me to Your Heaven. That's a banger.
That's, I don't remember that one.
Oh, it was brilliant. Look it up.
I'm going to do that right now.
Yeah.
Well, not right now, after this.
Was it Conjurer? I think it was Conjurer. When we had them on, Dan from Conjurer, who was saying that I think they blast 80s songs, don't they, from the van?
Oh, no, that was, Gordon from Raging Speedhorn was saying that the Raging Speedhorn tour bus is just 80s music. And then Dan from Conjurer was talking about, one of the questions we had was just very short and sweet. Is it true about Kylie Rae Jepsen? And apparently, like, all of Conjurer love Kylie Rae Jepsen and went to see her, like, recently. And he was like, yeah, dead serious. Like, we love Kylie Rae Jepsen. There's no joke there.
And what?
Yeah. What we're into.
Yeah.
I love it.
I never understand this idea of why you would feel guilty about enjoying
something. I know.
You know, it's strange. Like, it's pleasure. Enjoy it. Like, you know.
I don't know. I do sometimes hover my finger over publish when I put that on Instagram. Like, oh, my guilty pleasure.
But I think there's this thing, isn't there, sometimes that, like, people assume. And I think people inside of metal too. Like, you kind of, if you like anything else, it's almost like blasphemy or treason. Especially in punk music, I mean, that's probably worse than metal, I think, for that kind of mindset. So I think we just do it just to kind of break down the walls of metal, don't we?
Well, to show, try and make it sound like we're doing something really cool. We're breaking down walls, you know, we're smashing the barriers. Yeah.
Do you know what I think is more, like, people should feel more guilty about is, like, liking shit metal, you know? Like, I wouldn't feel embarrassed to say, oh, I love, like, Lady Gaga or Sia or, like, you know, whatever, Eurovision pop. But I would feel super embarrassed if I liked a Five Finger Death Punch song or if I liked, you know, something on Saint Anger by Metallica. I would be like, oh, let's keep that to myself. You know what I mean? Like, people forget there's so much crap metal out there as well.
I'm still trying to figure out what Five Finger Death Punch are. I just don't understand them.
One of the things I pride myself on is never having heard a Five Finger Death Punch song. I've seen, like, what they look like, and I've kind of heard bits about them, and I've heard them described as military wife metal, which itself is absolutely bizarre.
Yeah.
I kind of get, like, they're kind of this, like...
Or butt rock, as Finn McKenzie's put it.
Butt rock, yeah, that's the other one. I've never heard a song, so my goal in life is to, is to be buried without ever hearing a Five Finger Death Punch song.
Yeah.
That's a good goal. I used to date someone who had, like, rocker parents, and the kind of parents who, like, you know, they have, like, T-shirts with a skull and a motorcycle and, like, a moon and a wolf. And I remember going around their house and meeting them, and the dad being like, oh, you've got tattoos, you're a rock chick, you're going to love this. Oh, let me sit down. Oh, you're going to be so good. It's so clever. He kept going about how clever it was. And it was the new Five Finger Death Punch song. Wow. And I had to just sort of sit there and go, yes.
I have to go now.
I'm part of a Facebook group that I'm not going to say what kind of Facebook group it is. Oh, it's a metal one, but I've kind of posted the podcast on it before. But I send Kieran screenshots from it every now and then. And it'll be like, Happy Monday. And it'll be like one of those, like, spray paint art, like, skeletons with, like, a top hat on, like, doing the devil horns. And honestly, with, like,
a cigarette and a bottle of Jack Daniels.
But I also, as well, like, with the parents you talk about then, I had an ex-girlfriend whose dad was, like, a really kind of meek, like, really mild-mannered guy, lovely guy, actually. He was always just really friendly, kind of very, very quiet, just really, like, super chill, like a really relaxed person. And I remember getting in his car one day, and he put Bodies by Drowning Pool on. And like he was like just like mad into it, and I was just like, wow. Damn, did not see that coming. So yeah,
I remember my gran once hearing System of a Down saying it was all right.
Yeah. It's like the compliment my dad gave Paolo from Trivium last week. Even I would listen to that.
Graham's dad's scale of whether music is good or not.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we've eaten to your evening quite a bit, but it's really good to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We digressed a bit, but I think this is one of the more interesting ones we've done. It's great to have a chat about roller coasters and Halloween, and more importantly, my holiday to Florida, which, you know, I love talking about.
Oh, thanks for having me. I had a great time. It's really fun.
And for anyone who hasn't checked out Svalbard, the new album, When I Die, Will I Get Better? That is the correct title. It's out now. So check it out because, yeah, massive album. Sounds immense, especially when you're cooking your pasta.
That's it.
That's what we made it for.
Yeah.
You heard it here. Thanks very much, Serena. Really appreciate it.
That was Serena Cherry of Bristol-based awesome shit-kicking band Svalbard.
Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. As I say, we really enjoyed talking to her. And we've got a really cool one lined up next. Are we allowed to say? I think we should say.
Well, yes, I give permission for this.
Okay, we're actually talking to James, who is the organizer of the 2000 Trees Festival.
Which I think we've discussed many times in this podcast.
Yeah, I've never been. I mean, I'm going next year if the world allows me to. But Kieran's been more than a few times, and I think it'll be really cool. It'll be our first guest, or second guest, actually, who isn't directly connected with the band. So that'll be a really interesting chat.
Is Svalbard playing 2000 Trees this year? I'm going to have a look now. Please hold.
I do not know.
But yeah, if you haven't been to 2000 Trees, it is sick. One of the best things I love about this festival is, like, you've got, you know, Leeds Festival and all that is great, but they're so big, aren't they? I think it can take you like 20 minutes to walk from your tent to even to get into the arena. 2000 Trees, you're pretty much camping in the arena. Like, there's enough people there that it's got a quality atmosphere. They have a silent disco at night, which is amazing. But you can grab your beers and walk down to the stage. You've not got to go through all like the, you know, going through the security and all that. It's all in the same area. So really what I'm basically saying is I like the fact that I can take my own beer.
That is amazing because I went to Leeds Festival for pretty much 10 years straight between like 2001 and 2000, I think it was 2010. And to have to like not be able to take anything near the stage and have to buy their overpriced pints was definitely a bit of a buzzkill. So also with 2000 Trees, who makes sure that there are 2000 trees each year? Does it decrease or increase and they have to adjust that? What happens there? We'll ask James, I guess.
I've counted them and, there was actually 2001, but I mean, you don't want to be picky, do you? But they've got a cracking lineup. I'm just having a look at it. So Jimmy Eat World, if anyone's ever heard of them, a little band called Thrice. They haven't announced the last, is it the Sunday headliner?
Headliner,
it was AFI, wasn't it, before they cancelled it? So I'm hoping it's AFI again. I can't see Svalbard on the lineup, but These Nuts are on there. Boston Manor, Young Guns, Amazon's Creeper, Menzingers.
So it's mainly kind of punk oriented, isn't it? It's kind of leans, there's a bit of metal there from when I looked at it, but leans more towards punk and hardcore.
Yeah, when I last went there was a lot of heavier bands there. Raging Speed, we said, didn't we, in that episode, Raging Speed on, we're playing, and I was too tired to go and see him. I was lying down at the tent.
So embarrassing when you had to tell Gordon from Raging Speed on that.
Yeah.
You're like, do you know what, mate? I went to a festival that you played, and I could hear you in the tent, but I just couldn't be bothered getting up and watch.
It wasn't couldn't be bothered. I just had too much to drink and was just very tired. You know, my weary legs.
I know you were. I'm sure Gordon forgives you.
Gordon, if you listen to this, please forgive me. Anyway, back onto the guest that we just had. Yeah, so Svalbard, fucking awesome band. Check out the newest album, When I Die, Will I Get Better? Because, as I said in the interview, they kind of hit the nail on the head with this album. It's wicked. Really enjoying it. One of the best albums this year, easily. Yep.
And don't forget, if you enjoyed this, check us out on social media. We probably post more stuff on Instagram than the other channel, than the other accounts. And if you're able to leave us a review on any streaming service, it is always greatly appreciated. And tell a mate, tell your gran,
I don't know. Tell someone, because we'd love that.
Tell my gran.
Yeah, tell Kieran's gran. Get in touch. Her number is 07843.
999. Tell anyone's gran, really. That's after that campaign we did when we first promoted our episode. We promoted it all to I think it was like over 60s, wasn't it, or something. And we were getting all these like elderly pensioners commenting on the thing, saying, "Oh, this is a lovely picture."
Yeah, we paid like money to Facebook, and I think we messed the audience up. And it was like lots.
I just had the bright idea that I'd think, oh, well, let's set this as wide as possible. So I put it from age 18 to age 60, I think, or something, thinking, you know, it doesn't really matter what age you are. Everyone's into, you know, a lot of age ranges are into metal, but it turned out Facebook kind of pushed it all towards the over 60 demographic. And then,
yeah, like it, Doris. It wasn't 60. It was well older than that. We had like loads of like lovely old grannies commenting on our 4-year strong picture. Oh, I do love a bit of Easy Core.
Oh, that was so funny, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, get your nan down. Well, when lockdown's lifted, get your nan down to the next Svalbard tour because she will love it. We'll hopefully see you there.
Yeah, we will. Catch you next time.
Yeah. See you later. Budrock.
I love you.
Budrock.
Oh, you ruined it.
103.9 playing Budrock. Anyway, I'm going now. Bye.
See you later, mate.